Welcome to the Lynn Rivers Show. I'm Lynn Rivers. Mr. Filburn had a farm, E-I-E-I-O, and on this farm he had some wheat, E-I-E-I-O. But the year was 1938, and Franklin Roosevelt had set quotas on agricultural production in an attempt to shore up the economy. Farmer Filburn exceeded his quota and was prosecuted under the law. The court ruled against him on the basis of the Commerce Clause in the U.S. Constitution. What's the Commerce Clause? Why is it in the Constitution? And what does it have to do with the Obama health care plan? Today in our continuing series on landmark legal cases, we'll discuss Wickard v. Filburn, probably the most important case you've never heard of. Joining me on the phone today is U of M law professor Nicholas Bagley. Professor Bagley teaches and writes in the areas of administrative law, regulatory theory, and health law. Prior to joining the law school faculty, he was an attorney with the U.S. Department of Justice, where he argued a dozen cases before the U.S. Courts of Appeals and acted as lead counsel in many more. Professor Bagley also served as a law clerk to Supreme Court Justice John Paul Stevens and U.S. Court of Appeals Judge David S. Tatel. His work has appeared in the Columbia Law Review, the New York University Law Review, the Harvard Journal on Legislation, and the Washington Post and Slate.com. Professor Bagley, thank you for joining me today.
Happy to be here.
And we will be joined shortly by EMU Professor Barry Pyle. But Professor Bagley, let's sort of set the stage. We're going to start with the Filburn case, Wickard v. Filburn, as a way to sort of set the scene for discussions of the Commerce Clause, and ultimately how this string of cases may affect the court's consideration of the Affordable Care Act, the Obama health plan that is now slated to be reviewed by the Supreme Court. So can you set the stage for us with Filburn?
Sure, absolutely. So in the decades prior to the New Deal, the Supreme Court had issued a series of decisions imposing meaningful but hard-to-define constraints on Congress's ability to regulate interstate commerce. The court was playing a fairly assertive role. The court even invalidated a couple of early New Deal statutes on the grounds that they exceeded Congress's commerce power. A frustrated President Roosevelt proposed adding six new justices to the Supreme Court in an effort to pack the court with justices who would rule favorably on New Deal legislation.
The argument was he wasn't trying to pack the court. He was just giving those aging justices a little extra help.
Sure, and pretty much everybody and their sister saw through that one.
Right.
So the plan didn't go through because the Supreme Court relented even as it was pending. For more than 50 years then, from 1937 to 1995, the court invalidated not a single exercise of congressional authority on the ground that it exceeded Congress's powers under the Commerce Clause. And Wickard against Filburn, which was decided in 1942, was for many years taken as the high watermark of Commerce Clause jurisprudence and of Commerce Clause power. And the case involved the Agricultural Adjustment Act, in which the federal government set a quota on the amount of wheat that farmers in the United States could grow. And the idea was to stabilize the price for wheat by restraining its oversupply. Farmers were growing too much wheat, the price for wheat was dropping, and they were having a hard time making ends meet. The notion was if you set a quota, everybody will get their fair share. Ruinous competition won't drive a bunch of small farmers out of business.
So Farmer Filburn runs into a problem. How?
Well, Farmer Filburn wanted to grow more wheat than his allotment permitted. So there's an overall nationwide quota that's set, and each individual farmer is given a quota based on past year's production. He was given a quota of 222 bushels of wheat. Farmer Filburn ran a dairy farm, and he used that wheat to feed his cows. Among other things. When he harvested more than twice as much as his allotment, the federal government fined him a whopping $130. He challenged the fine on the ground that Congress lacked the power under the Commerce Clause to set a quota for homegrown wheat production. He said, this is my business, it's not interstate commerce.
To sort of remind people, the Commerce Clause in the United States Constitution, Article 1, Section 8, reads that Congress has the power to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. So Filburn says that doesn't cover the wheat that I'm growing for myself.
Exactly. I'm growing this wheat on my farm to feed my cows, and there's nothing relating to interstate commerce at all in connection with my activities.
I want to introduce my second guest who's just joined us. EMU political science professor Barry Pyle is here today. He has been a friend to this show, and we're happy to have him again. He teaches political science at Eastern Michigan University and has written widely on the American judicial system. Along with Elaine Martin, he has written Gender and Racial Diversification in State Supreme Courts. This article was noted by Political Science Quarterly as one of the best and most comprehensive works on the jurisprudence and gender stratification pervasive in the United States legal system. Dr. Pyle, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
This is the Lynn Rivers Show, and today we are talking about Supreme Court case Wickard v. Filburn. It is a case that centers on the Commerce Clause, and we're going to look not only at that case, but the progeny of that case, as well as how that decision might impact the Supreme Court's review of the Obama health care plan. Dr. Pyle, Professor Bagley and I were talking about sort of setting up the Filburn case. The situation was quotas. Filburn wants to raise his own. This ends up being a Commerce Clause case. What did the court say about the Commerce Clause, this particular set of legislation, and his desire to feed his chickens with his own wheat?
Well, Wickard versus Filburn represents, I think, in a large part, the court's statement on the Commerce Clause after the 1937 case of Jones versus Laughlin Steele. And to my mind, Wickard versus Filburn is sort of the cap on the court's alteration of the policy and its interpretation of the Commerce Clause. The important part of Wickard versus Filburn is they took a look at those 239 extra bushels of wheat and said, it's not just Roscoe, it's not just Filburn's farm, but it's everyone who's similarly situated. And so they looked at Filburn not as an individual farmer, but as a group or as a representative of a group. And if all the farmers, wheat farmers in the United States, kept an extra 239 extra bushels of wheat, that would have a substantial effect on interstate commerce. That's why this case is so important, because it uses that aggregate effects notion.
So one of the things, I mean, if you can interpret that in a way that's kind of scary, which is, no, Mr. Filburn, you can't grow your own animal food. You have to spend money out there on the market to feed your animal. I mean, it's sort of like, could the government say to me, you're not eating enough canned tomatoes? You can't put your own tomatoes up. You have to buy them at the store?
It's funny you should say that. I've used that actual illustration in class. And if you push it off until it's the logical conclusion, you might be able to get there. And that's part of the danger of this. I ask my classes, if Filburn's growing of the wheat in the aggregate has a substantial effect on interstate commerce, what does not? Flushing one's toilet, brushing one's teeth. If you take 300 million people engaging in an activity, that's going to have some sort of effect on commerce and interstate or international commerce.
Professor Bagley, let me ask you, how does this provision get in the Constitution to begin with? We end up seeing that among the very diverse powers that Congress has given is this ability to regulate commerce. Why is it there? Does this grow out of some sort of problem?
Yeah, the Articles of Confederation had provided a fairly weak centralized federal government, and for a variety of sort of coordination problems that arise in interstate trade, you need a robust federal government to make sure that there's sort of a clear rules for the road. The Interstate Commerce Clause was intended to set those rules of the road, but the point, or at least the idea, in the, that the founders came at the document with was, let's preserve room for intrastate regulation. We don't want to give to the federal government a plenary police power. And so that's why when Barry talks about the sort of slippery slope that this argument allows, that's why people view that the Wickard case with some suspicion. The notion is, well, gosh, if you can aggregate the effects that anybody might have on interstate commerce and then justify a regulation with respect to those effects, we've now given to the federal government considerable authority that was, at least as an original matter, meant to be left to the states.
But one of the things that people point out is, while the Commerce Clause specifically grants authority to Congress, we read it to prohibit state action around interstate commerce. We see this as an exclusive role for the federal government. Is that a good reading of the Constitution?
What you're referring to is a doctrine that's grown up, sort of a judicial innovation known as the Dormant Commerce Clause. And the idea is we don't want states to enact invidious legislation that discriminates against the goods or the products of the people from other states. And what we want is a sort of free trade zone between states. And so if a state enacts a discriminatory piece of legislation, the courts will strike that down on the ground that Congress alone has the authority to regulate interstate commerce. Congress can authorize the states to enact discriminatory legislation if it so desires, but the presumption is that states are not permitted to enact that kind of discriminatory legislation.
So Barry, is this why Michigan can't pass laws keeping Canadian and out-of-state trash from coming into our landfills?
Yes. Yeah. It's that simple. In fact, the professor's correct. For the first 70 to 80 years, the Dormant Commerce Clause is exactly what the court dealt with. And it wasn't until EC Knight Sugar and the growth of the economy and the growth of businesses, where businesses were large enough to be engaged in activities on an economic level that were interstate in nature, that Congress began to regulate through things like the Sherman Antitrust Act.
Well, let's talk about the sort of the time in which this decision comes down. It's the law is passed in 1938. We're in the Depression. The economy is in trouble. People are frightened. And ultimately, the court accepts this argument in 1942. Do you think they would have decided differently if the tenor of the times were different?
Well, they were deciding differently. As early as 1936, in a case called Carter Cole versus Carter, the court had sort of gone back and thrown back to the early days of EC Knight Sugar and upheld, at least in its dicta, others would say in its doctrine, a distinction between what it called a direct and indirect effect on interstate commerce. And it was that distinction that the court, it's a precarious distinction, it's a difficult distinction to put forward in a complicated interstate economic, in an area of interstate economic activity. But the court simply said, look, if it's production or manufacturing or you're digging something out of the ground or it's some form of retail sales, that's the providence of the state. It took that 1 year, and in fact it was just a few months, for the court to change its mind in Jones and Laughlin Steel. But the difference there was, in that particular case, you're dealing with a very large corporation that was engaged clearly in interstate commerce. It's that short 5 years that you go from a large corporation to one guy on his farm growing 11.9 extra acres of wheat.
Professor Bagley, I'm going to turn to you. Do you think, you talked about the court packing attempt and the so-called a switch in time saves nine. Is that what you think happened here, that the court changed its position because of pressure from the president or from the public, or was there something else going on here?
Well, so it's hard to say for certain. The justice who switched his vote to save nine was at the time Justice Roberts, not the current Chief Justice, but he switched his vote in a case called West Coast Hotel Company against Parrish involving the minimum wage. And the vote in that case was taken before FDR announced his court packing plan. So a lot of people have looked at this and said, you know, it wasn't really the court packing plan that caused the shift to switch its views about the scope of the Commerce Clause in Parrish and then in Jones and Laughlin, which involved a challenge to the National Labor Relations Act, but instead just a changing vision on the court. I think more broadly, it's hard not to see the shift of the court as being a response to the times and the Depression and a newly kind of invigorated understanding of the federal government's power against the backdrop of a more thoroughly related sort of interstate economy. So even if it wasn't directly the court packing plan that caused the switch in time, I do think it's safe to say that it was a sort of big social shift that help prod the court into a more welcoming direction.
Mm-hmm. Barry, let me ask you, we talked a few minutes ago about how the Commerce Clause made its way into the Constitution. You had problems facing the country. You had national issues being addressed on a state-by-state basis. It's not working out. They changed the structure of the government. Is that what's happening during the Depression, that we have a national crisis, and if we left it the way it was, it would be state-by-state solutions?
Mm-hmm. And you see that in what was going on in Congress. You certainly see that coming out of the executive branch and FDR and the New Deal. And you see that in some of the court's later decisions as it goes into the 1940s with Darby Lumber and Wickard itself, that you need these national policies to solve national problems. And I would agree fully with the professor that it probably wasn't the specific court packing plan that wasn't going to pass Congress. But what the court packing plan represented was the political branches of government's disgust with the court and how the court had routinely overturned a large number of New Deal legislation throughout the early 1930s. We don't sort of grab hold of just to the magnitude of political change that had taken place during the New Deal. One of my favorite statistics is the number of Republican seats in the House of Representatives in 1929, and that number was 267. By 1937, that was cut to 89. So what you have is a cataclysmic shift, tectonic shift in the sort of politics and the political nature, and it was towards more national policies and away from what the focus had been on states' rights and states' governments from the 1890s up through the 1930s.
Now, Nick, you said a minute ago that once that decision was made, there was an incredibly long period, decades, where the court was unwilling to strike down any federal regulation on this basis. You talked about the National Labor Relations Board. How did this case about 110 bushels of wheat turn into a situation where the federal government starts regulating labor law?
Well, the labor legislation was actually enacted before the Agricultural Adjustment Act. But the National Labor Relations Act was a seminal piece of legislation in U.S. history. It was intended to establish the right of employees to organize and bargain collectively, and it established a board, the NLRB, to oversee collective bargaining and to make sure that employers were engaging in fair employment practices. That kind of intrusive government oversight of business practices, federal government oversight of business practices, was up to that point unheard of. So that was just one example of the kind of sweeping powers that the federal government assumed over the next 50, 60 years. And that includes regulations relating to environmental protection. It touches on regulations pertaining to employment discrimination. It touches on virtually every aspect of our lives. And it's difficult to overstate the extent to which the federal role has grown over the past 70 years. The federal government is now an important sovereign in a way that was just categorically different 100 years ago.
This is the Lynn Rivers Show right here on 89.1 WEMU, and we are talking today about the Commerce Clause in the United States Constitution, and my guests are EMU political science professor Barry Pyle and U of M law professor Nicholas Bagley. Let me go back to this issue of expansion, because expansion of federal powers. One of the issues that Professor Bagley, I know you are intimately interested in, is this question of the Obama health care plan, the Patient Protection and Affordable Care Act. It's been accepted by the Supreme Court. They're going to hear it in this term. What can we draw, if anything, from Wickard and the progeny of Wickard and postulate about what the court's going to do with the health care plan?
Well, although the court was really hands-off when it came to Commerce Clause jurisprudence for a lot of years, there were two cases, one in 1995 and one in 2000, that signaled that the Supreme Court might be a little less willing to defer to Congress in this field than it had been before. In 1995, the court struck down the Gun-Free School Zones Act, which prohibited the handling of possession of weapons within a school zone. And in 2000, it struck down the Violence Against Women Act, which prohibited and posed penalties for committing violent acts against women.
Well, they struck them down now because they said, for people that are not necessarily familiar with how Congress operates, they have at least in my view, two positions when they are questioned on why they're doing what they're doing. They have sort of two run home to mama arguments. One is the Commerce Clause. The other one is the Necessary and Proper Clause. So what the court said in Lopez, the one that you first mentioned, was, look, you can't argue that you regulate guns because guns get bought and sold. Is that analogous to what the Obama administration is proposing? I mean, do we have a situation where this is only tangentially, at best, a correct thing for the federal government to do? I mean, is it like Lopez, or is it somehow different?
Well, I think it's hard to argue that it's a lot like Lopez. In Lopez, the court said, look, possessing a gun in a school zone just has nothing to do with the economy in any kind of conventional understanding of the word. Whereas the individual mandate in the Affordable Care Act is an effort to require people who do not have health insurance and who, if they get sick, may pass along the costs of their health care to others to participate in the interstate market and health insurance. And nobody really doubts that the regulations of the insurance markets that are included in the Affordable Care Act and the individual mandate will collectively have substantial effects on interstate commerce. The argument that challengers are making is that it's not appropriate for the government to regulate economic inactivity. And the notion is, when I choose not to purchase insurance, I am inactive, and because I'm inactive, I am not properly subject to Congress's Commerce Clause powers.
So you're really talking about the difference between can't versus must.
That's certainly an argument that is prominent in the litigation, the distinction between a regulation of action, a regulation of economic activity, and a regulation of inactivity. Now, you mentioned the Necessary and Proper Clause. One of the funny features of the litigation that's pending before the Supreme Court is that the federal government has made the very strong claim that, look, even if compelling people to purchase insurance isn't a regulation of, you know, it is a regulation of economic inactivity in some sense, that doesn't matter because the Necessary and Proper Clause gives us the authority to take any necessary and proper steps to further the legitimate goals that we have in the Affordable Care Act of expanding the private insurance markets to make sure that they can accommodate everybody.
Well, when I teach, I'm going to turn to Dr. Pyle. When I teach the Necessary and Proper Clause, I point out that action has to be tied pretty clearly to an enumerated power in Article 1, Section 8. So the government is arguing which power, Dr.
Commerce Pyle? Clause. They say, look, we're regulating the insurance markets, and in regulating the insurance markets, we're requiring insurers to accept people with pre-existing conditions, and we're requiring those insurers to provide insurance to anybody who asks, regardless of health status. So when the federal government enacts those regulations of the interstate insurance market, nobody doubts that that's a proper exercise of its Commerce Clause power. And the federal government then says, given that we have enacted these regulations, the Necessary and Proper Clause allows us to enact the individual mandate, which is necessary to make those regulations of the interstate insurance market effective.
So, Dr. Pyle, let me turn to you. Professor Bagley just said nobody would argue. Having been in the national political arena, everybody argues about everything. Is there what is the opposite argument here?
Well, the opposite argument, and it's the professor's correct. It's you're using the ability to regulate commerce to force someone to engage in an economic activity or be fined
for it. To engage
in
commerce.
So it would, instead of controlling how much wheat Filburn grew, it would be forcing Filburn to grow wheat when he wanted to raise pumpernickel.
But didn't it require him to go out and buy his chicken feed in the market? I mean, didn't it cause him to have to do something?
The argument of the government was, we're not regulating that. We're regulating his ability to market his wheat and how much wheat he can market. And in fact, scholarship has, and economists who've looked at the Filburn case have argued that all regulation does this. As soon as you regulate someone's activity, it changes the other choices that they're going to make as you go further down the economic chain.
Professor Bagley, let me ask you, as you compare the court today, certainly this is a less liberal court than we saw through the 1960s. Is this court like the courts that FDR was facing in the 1930s?
Well, all time periods are different,
right,
and they all have their similarities. It is a much more conservative court than we had even just 20 or 30 years ago. It's a much more conservative court than we had even a decade ago. And they are significantly more concerned with imposing limits on federal authority than past courts have been. Whether that will translate into a vote against the Affordable Care Act is really anybody's guess.
Well, would they have to overrule Filburn to do that?
No. The courts are pretty, you know, you can always distinguish past cases, and you can say, look, nobody there was forcing Mr. Filburn to go out into the market to buy his wheat, although even though in practical effect that's what he would have had to do, but nobody imposed an actual mandate, whereas here in this case there is a fairly novel assertion of federal power to compel individuals to participate in a private market. And I think it would be, you know, a matter, in terms of crafting an opinion, the court could make that categorical distinction. Whether that is persuasive is another question altogether, but I don't think they would have to do anything like overrule Filburn to reach that result if that was what they wanted.
Well, let me offer another way of approaching this. Originally, the Obama administration said, this is not a tax, this is not a tax, this is not a tax. But they can, the federal government can impose taxes. Why not treat this as a tax or see this as a tax? Does that give the federal government an in a way that perhaps Commerce Clause doesn't?
It does. And in fact, the arguments are floating around the case that this should be sustained on the taxing power. The trouble, as you mentioned, is that both Congress and the government and the president ran from the characterizing this mandate as a tax. Just background on the way it works, right? The mandate says that if you don't purchase insurance, you have to pay a penalty, a tax penalty, right? And in using the word penalty, right, arguably Congress adverted, Congress declined to exercise its taxing authority and decided not to rest on the taxing authority. Now, had it simply called the penalty that it was imposing a tax, if it had said we are going to tax your choice not to purchase insurance, many people believe the statute would be on very firm constitutional footing. Having characterized the financial assessment as a penalty, arguably they can't disclaim it being a tax when they're enacting it and then wrap themselves in the taxing power at the end of the day.
One last question for you, because I know you have to run. You follow this very closely. What is your prediction about what the court's going to do with this statute?
I think it's very hard to handicap the case, and that's in part because, you know, you and I can talk about doctrine, and the court will consider doctrine when it rules in the case. But ultimately, the questions at issue in the Affordable Care Act are questions about national self-definition, and they sort of draw on views about the proper role of federal authority and the intrusiveness of a federal state. I find it very difficult to sort of weigh in on those more abstract questions. I think you really have to sort of get pretty deep down in the psyches of the individual justices, and we're just going to have to see.
Okay. Well, Professor Nicholas Bagley, thank you so much for joining me here today.
Thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.
That was U of M Law Professor Nicholas Bagley. My other guest today right here on the Lynn Rivers Show is EMU Political Science Professor Barry Pyle. We are talking about Wickard v. Filburn, a case from the 1940s dealing with the Commerce Clause. So, Barry, let me turn to sort of the progeny. And we and we talked a little bit earlier about Lopez, just briefly. I want to talk about U.S. v. Lopez. Why don't you give us a little clearer understanding of what that case was about?
Okay. Congress had passed an act banning the possession and the carrying onto school grounds of weapons. Texas had laws against this. The local community had laws against this. Somehow, this ended up being a federal case. And Mr. Lopez got himself a fairly decent attorney who challenged the act on the Commerce Clause. And so the court asked a very simple question: is carrying a gun onto school property something Congress can regulate with the Interstate Commerce Clause? Now, this is where Wickard comes in, and what Chief Justice Rehnquist does at the time is he takes the opportunity in Lopez to reconstruct and redefine the court's establishments, the court's Commerce Clause jurisprudence, and he says there are three areas that the court, that Congress can regulate. They can regulate the instrumentalities of Congress or commerce. They can regulate trains. They can regulate trucking. They can regulate the shipping of goods. They can also regulate goods that are being shipped. So, you know, the goods that are on the ship, the goods that are on the truck can be regulated by Congress. And then finally, he said under Wickard versus Filburn and under Jones and Laughlin Steele, Congress can regulate activity that has a substantial effect on interstate commerce. And this is where the rubber hits the road, where the court is having to make those fine, narrow calls. And Professor Begley's correct. For the most part, since 1941, the court has consistently found that Congress's activities in regulating interstate commerce are constitutional, whether it be the Civil Rights Acts, whether it be the FLSA or the Fair Labor Standards Act, whether it be OSHA. All of those acts are premised on the Interstate Commerce Clause. But when you get to an individual carrying a gun onto school property, the court took pause. Some of this is because of the changes in personnel on the court that had taken place during the Reagan administration and George Bush putting Justice Thomas onto the court.
Well, but I mean, the federal government's argument, which is guns are bought and sold, therefore they are an item of commerce, ergo we can regulate it, we can put a criminal statute into effect. The court just wasn't buying that.
Well, the argument went further afield than that. The justices in dissent used a cost of crime argument.
Yeah, Justice Stevens, yes.
That by, in fact, Congress, and part of one of the difficulties in this case was Congress hadn't said specifically how this relates to the Interstate Commerce Clause. It was merely assumed. I think you referred to it as a go-to-mama moment.
Yes.
They just simply assumed that over the last 70 years, they've been able to use the Interstate Commerce Clause almost with impunity, and they're going to do it again. And the court took pause. The dissenters in the case argued that education was necessary to generate employees. Employees are necessary to have an economy. Without employees in that particular area, it's going to affect the type of businesses that are attracted to that area, and that's going to have an impact on interstate commerce. Justice Rehnquist says that connection is far too tenable. We cannot sustain this. Lopez's activities are not economic, and they're not covered by the Interstate Commerce Clause.
And it also would set up a situation where there would be virtually nothing beyond the regulation of Congress, because everything is bought and sold.
Well, that's the exact same argument of Justice Sutherland in dissent in Jones and Laughlin Steele and the Flame Black case early on in the 1940s and late 1930s. And he may have been prophetic. People don't realize that the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and 1971 are all premised on the Interstate Commerce Clause. And some of the early cases involving the Civil Rights Act involved, does the Commerce Clause apply to an interstate hotel operator? Does it apply to a restaurant owner who happened to have booths that he bought from another state and he serves chickens that were raised in another state? If he's engaged in interstate commerce, then he's covered by the Civil Rights Act.
Today we are talking about Wickard v. Filburn, which is another case in our continuing series on landmark civil rights cases. It may not be one you have heard of, but it's probably the most important one that you have never heard of. It deals with the Commerce Clause from the United States Constitution. And as I read earlier in the show, the Commerce Clause says that Congress has the ability to regulate commerce with foreign nations and among the several states and with the Indian tribes. So, Dr. Pyle, let's go back to this issue of Lopez. So Congress says, well, of course we can do this. We can make a connection, no matter how gossamer, between interstate commerce and these guns. Court says no. Let's talk about Gonzales v. Raich, which is the case about growing pot. Mm-hmm. It looks like the argument of the government is we can regulate medicinal pot because it competes with black market pot.
That's precisely their argument. And Wickard versus Filburn looms large in Raich, and Justice Stevens uses it throughout the opinion, in fact, to argue that Congress has a long history of regulating the movement of illicit drugs, including marijuana, across state lines. And by growing marijuana on her windowsill, she's interfering with Congress's ability to regulate illegal traffic in marijuana.
Right. This woman had lived in a medical marijuana state, had the had the ability to do it. She grew it herself, and they said no.
Right. And that's what makes it so closely aligned with Filburn, that she's growing marijuana that the Congress doesn't want her to grow. Very similar, and Stevens picks up on this, very similar to those extra 239 bushels of wheat.
Right. So the question has to be, they have the ability to regulate narcotics.
Mm-hmm.
Why not just simply use police powers as opposed to going to this convoluted Commerce Clause argument?
Because Congress doesn't have national police powers. And this has been the discussion and the argument and the tension that's taken place around the Commerce Clause from very early on. And that is, if Congress can regulate everything under the Interstate Commerce Clause, then that creates a national police power.
But we
that brings in the tension between the nation and the states.
But you, I mean, certainly we know that there are federal drug crimes. We know that certain drugs are made illegal under federal law. What's the difference?
But they're all premised on the movement of those drugs from state to state. And when Lopez was decided, the legal profession, and especially those who study constitutional law, took a deep gasp. Because if the court was going to not allow the carrying of a gun onto school, well, what about drugs? What about interstate control of arson, which was also raised in cases right after Lopez? What about, eventually, the Violence Against Women Act in Morrissey that prohibited rape, in that case, on a college campus?
But the Gonzales-Raich case is 2005, so that's a relatively
recent. Yeah.
So can we project out of that decision whether or not can we learn anything from that decision about what the court may be doing, may do with this new case?
With healthcare?
Yeah.
Maybe. It's hard to read, and it comes down to, it's argued, and Justice Roberts smiled when he changed his vote from Carter Cole to Jones and Laughlin Steele. He said, it might have been what I had for breakfast that morning, and he never said another peep about it. It could be what Justice Kennedy has for breakfast that morning. But the important part of the healthcare cases will be, will the court allow Congress to take that next step to force someone to engage in an economic activity under an act in the under a portion of the Constitution that's designed merely to regulate activity that has already taken place?
So the position they may well take, if they say no, is that while the states have the ability to require us to purchase things like no-fault insurance, et cetera, the federal government just doesn't have that power under the Constitution.
They could very well take that tack. There's also the court has an escape clause here, which is standing. The standing issue has been raised in some of the lower court cases. It could very well be that the court won't be able to reach a decision, or at least a decision that can be communicated in, a controversial 5-4 decision, which is what this will ultimately be.
So what you're saying is that there are certain procedural issues. In order to have standing, you have to have a personalized, particular injury. It has to be you specifically who was injured. Also, there are ripeness requirements. Mm-hmm. It has to actually have happened. And so you have people who are not yet affected by this because most of it hasn't gone into effect. Nobody's had to pay a fine. So how does this issue get before the court?
It gets before the court under the Florida case. The district court judge said that there's nothing out there that's going to prohibit the individuals who are also a part of the case. Everyone talks about the 26 states who are part of the big Florida case. But there were also individuals involved to get around this standing problem. Nobody doubts that these individuals will be forced to either acquire health care or pay a fine. The court said the harm is close enough. the court could end up saying the harm is not close enough and therefore boot the case down the road, maybe till after the presidential election next year.
Mm-hmm. Listeners, this is the Lynn Rivers Show here on 89.1 WEMU, and this show is part of our continuing series on landmark legal cases. We are talking about Wickard v. Filburn, a case from 1942 that deals with the Commerce Clause, and we're now looking at the cases that have come out of that. Let me go on in a different tact here about the court. I mean, one of the things that gets argued about the labor laws that come out of the Commerce Clause, about the civil rights laws that come, is that the court moved not just from a legal perspective in those cases, but from a practical perspective, which is the states aren't going to do these things. The states aren't willing to recognize equality. They continue to discriminate. Their people are being abused in their role as workers. And so the federal government has to step in, and the court allows that. Do we have the same sort of thing working here? I mean, everyone seems to agree we've got problems with our health care system. Is this the sort of thing that maybe the court would say, you know, we need some sort of national solution here?
I'm sure that argument, if the court reaches the substantive issues in the case, that argument will loom large in either the majority opinion or the dissenting opinion. And I think you're right to mention that where the court has sort of pushed the boundaries of commerce, it has been around the need to create national policy. Certainly with economic regulations in the late 1930s, 1940s, 1950s, and then moving on to the civil rights legislation, and then increased workforce workplace regulation with things like OSHA in the 60s and the 70s. The court had, and even applying some of these, like the Fair Labor Standards Act, minimum wage, minimum hours, to states themselves in the late 1960s and the mid-1980s, where the national government was telling states how to deal with their own employees. And so you have all of these undercurrents of federalism. You have, raw national power being expanded, maybe certainly beyond where it may have been intended, and certainly beyond where it had been practiced for the first 120 years of the Republic.
Well, let's take a look at that, because as you go back in the history, at the Constitutional Convention, it's all about cutting power into little bitty pieces.
Right.
Horizontally between the branches, vertically between the federal government and the states. It was never to create a huge overarching national government. It was supposed to be a sharing of power. As the Commerce Clause is used more and more and more and has been accepted by the courts, haven't we really disrupted the balance that we were supposed to see?
Yeah, that assumes there could be a balance from the very beginning. Having young children, I know that sharing isn't that easy.
That's right.
Well, they're not that young anymore. And this came up in Gibbons. In Gibbons and Ogden, the first case the court heard with the Commerce Clause is how do the states share the ability to regulate navigation between New Jersey and New York? And Marshall, in that opinion, probably raised more questions than he answered by saying sort of generically, well, sometimes interstate commerce can enter into the state. And because there's interstate commerce, there must be intrastate commerce, and we have to draw a line between those two things. But we don't have to do it in this case. And so even though there may have been this veneer or overlay of separating powers between Congress and the president and between the national government and the state governments, we well know over time those simple divisions that maybe appeared to be workable at one point get confused and get more complicated as the economy grows or as situations change.
But let me raise two other instances of this, and both of them have to do with state power relative to their own employees. We've had cases about background checks. The federal government tried to make local and state police agencies do background checks for the federal gun laws. And then you had a situation where the federal government wanted to enforce the Disabilities Act on state employees. In both of those cases, it looks like the court stepped back from some of their other decisions and recognized state powers. Can you speak to that?
Sure. There we're dealing with a little bit outside of the Interstate Commerce Clause, but it's all interrelated because Congress's power over the states, specifically as states, is directly, again, related back to the Interstate Commerce Clause and its junction with the Necessary and Proper Clause. You're talking about Prince versus the United States and a series of cases that the court heard in the 1990s dealing with the ADA and the application to the states. In Prince, it was, can the federal government mandate that chief local law enforcement officers do these background checks? And Justice Scalia, again, shocking everyone, a case about the same time as Lopez, says, no, we're a system of dual sovereignties. States have sovereignty. Well, that language hadn't been used, again, since the days of Wickard and Filburn.
But, I mean, isn't there a reasonable basis for that? I mean, the idea is if the federal government can reach into state and local work relationships and say, look, your people have to do this on our behalf. I mean, wouldn't you see, I mean, the sovereignty of the state vaporizes?
Of course, and that's Justice O'Connor's argument in a similar case in 1992, New York versus United States. She says, look, federalism and the division of powers between the state and the national government is there for a reason. It's there to check national power. It's there to check state power.
Listeners, this is the Lynn Rivers Show right here on 89.1 WEMU. My guest today is political science professor Barry Pyle. We are talking about the Commerce Clause, about federalism, and we started with the case Wickard v. Filburn. Let's go back to this issue of sovereignty, because I think it's important. There are a lot of people today that see no reason to limit the federal government in any way. Like, look, this is how we get things done. Who cares about state rights? Is there an argument to be made for today for states' rights?
Yes, fully. States, and this, the arguments go back way back in time. States can work as the laboratory for policy. One of the arguments that Mitt Romney will probably come up with eventually is that, you know, we need, and he actually is making the argument right now, that instead of having a national healthcare system, the state should be allowed to experiment like he did in Massachusetts. And then he'll claim, well, it wasn't the greatest policy ever adopted, but at least we tried. And other states can adapt it to their situation or try something completely different. That argument is out there. And there's also, to me, there's a democratic argument, a small d democratic argument, that if you allow the people in the state to make choices for themselves in their state, then there's an ability to have a closer connection between the people and their legislators. It's, you know, being a former member of Congress, you know, it's kind of hard to have a relationship with 500,000 people. But if you're a state rep, you know, it's a little bit easier to have a relationship with, you know, a couple thousand people and have that closer connection. So there's that sort of the centralized power notion or the more sort of local ability to govern and adapt policies for local problems. Not all problems are national.
Right. Well, but let me point out, or let me just raise the issue that it doesn't seem to matter which party is in power. Whoever controls the federal government wants to control the country. Is that a fair statement?
I think so. And sometimes they want to control the country by giving power back to the states, because the states are going to do what they agree with, whereas they can't make those changes at the federal level. I think that's true. You send people to a central government. Well, that's going to be their focus for the most part.
And I know this is not really fair, but If Thomas Jefferson could be here today, what would he say about this federal government?
He might be speechless. It is, and because of cases like Wickard versus Filburn, again, I hate to sort of harken back to this.
But that's why it's so
the
important.
Things have changed. Our system, our perception of what government it has changed. If we ask the listeners right now to give a description of their government, very few of them are going to mention their local municipal government or speak of Lansing. Their attention is directed directly to Washington, D.C.
Well, because that's what we see.
Exactly.
If you turn on the television, you don't see a disagreement in the State House, thank God. You'd see disagreements in Washington.
Right. And, you know, you don't even see that many. There might be more disagreements going on in Lansing just because paying attention.
there absolutely are.
Exactly.
I mean, the rule is when the legislature works at night, it's a bad, bad thing. Well, I want to thank you for being my guest today, Barry. It's always nice to talk with you.
Thank you very much, and I'm happy to be here anytime.
Great. I also want to thank U of M Law Professor Nick Bagley for joining me today. And you please join me next week for another edition of the Lynn Rivers Show. We'll talk about news, politics, history, or a mixture thereof. Radio that makes you think. The Lynn Rivers Show, right here on 89.1 WEMU.